If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at his website, fortitudetraining.net. Those who purchase Scott's book or any of his coaching products receive a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. So check out fortitudetraining.net. Muscle Minds is made possible in part by Jordan Peters. If you've enjoyed listening to Jordan today, check out his website, trainedbyjp.com. The site offers over 50 hours of video content covering everything from the most basic approach to training and nutrition for beginners, all the way through advanced anabolic and insulin strategies for seasoned competitors. You can follow Jordan and Corin's blog as they prep for their next shows and have questions answered daily on their forum section. So check out trainedbyjp.com. The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, Jordan Peters, and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting, presented by Nance Geek.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds, episode number 7. I'm Scott McNally, and with me as always is Dr. Scott Stevenson and Jordan Peters. Jordan, you sound like you're not feeling so hot today. What's going on, man?
I got ill after Ohio.
Oof. Yeah.
So, I pretty much, the day I got back, I trained, and then we recorded, and then the next day it hit me and I was just fucked. And I've had it since. I can't shake it.
Oh man.
So this is 2 weeks that I've had it now. Like it at one stage it was really bad. And like, I genuinely think I was coughing up lung
because
it was like, it was like really, really dark and bloody. But it was more like tissue than phlegm. So I don't even know what that was. But now it's like got a lot better, and now I'm just coughing up like really light coloured phlegm. So I know I'm pretty much there. And I was able to train this week. I only missed that 1 week of training.
Okay. That was going to be my next question. So you missed a week, and how does that affect you nutritionally? Because I remember you said right after the Arnold, like that while you were here, you just were pounding the food and you couldn't keep up.
Yeah, well, that was kind of frustrating because like I ended up dropping like 7 pounds whilst I was away. And then I got back and I couldn't train.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like 2 weeks of just crap. Which actually really, really pissed me off because timing wise, that was just at the end of an 8 week diet where I was then looking to rebound and just start introducing food and training equally hard out the gate and pushing back up. So I think I completely blew that rebound. I seem that way anyway because I've put some weight back on, but I just don't look as good as I was. So that's kind of pissed me off a bit.
Well, listen, this to me is a testament, though, that, you know, there's everybody out there. We've all got our excuses that we come up with. And I mean, any number of people, I get sick, everybody gets sick. And yeah. Even Jordan Peters gets sick. But I'm confident this is not going to stop you. You know, this is not going to keep you from reaching your goals.
Oh, fuck no. like today, I pulled a snatch grip deadlift PB today.
There you go.
There was no way. I don't know if you guys have done Snatch Group Deads, but they're hard.
I have not. Pull. No, I have not.
And I pulled 6.5 plates pretty comfortably.
Damn.
For 5 reps. The video's on my Instagram. So that was an all-time Snatch Group PB for me. Like, nice. I know that I can do 7 plates on that next time. Because it was kind of just like relearning that movement. Because if you get your lines wrong on that, then it'll just... The lift buries you. But, like, this won't hold me back. It's just a fucking cough.
No kidding. So, Scott, what's up with you, man?
I got sick after the Arnold too, but I'm mostly past it. my voice is only scratchy, I think, from being loud when I was training, because I'm just back from the gym. I got this lingering thing. I think this mold has come back in my house. Speaking of, you know, while we're on sort of talking about getting sick, so I've reinitiated all my my mold destroying strategies. In the house, I got my dehumidifier going. I bought this, what I think actually works, this sort of thermoelectric spore destroying piece that it requires some air to be flowing through it. So I've turned on the fan and my heater AC, and so I'm going after the mold. So, but I'm good. I had a good training session. I'm climbing back from being sick too, but I had a pretty good session. So.
I managed to get sick. I was sick right before the Arnold and had healed up a week before that. So maybe that made me immune. I don't know. I'm going to guess that Jordan's immune system just wasn't used to like the U.S. bugs. And that's why he's getting hit so hard. And now he's going to take that back and spread it to everybody in the U.K. This is how sickness spreads, isn't it?
Yes.
Pretty much. I think what got me was, like I said last week, that about 2 weeks ago when we recorded, was that I forgot my adapter. So the first night that I was there, I slept without my CPAP respirator.
Oh, okay.
You didn't sleep.
So that fucked me. And then I obviously did a session with BPAC, which he insisted we deadlifted in. So that then fucked me. And then my flight home was a night flight. So that was like... Two sleeps over 5 days with no CPAP, and then that just done me. I was always getting ill after that.
So you rely on that full time then? Do you use that just year round, 365 days a year?
Yeah, I can't do a night without it. Well, obviously I can, but it's not pleasant.
Right on.
It's not a fun night. Normally you'd wake up if you have quite bad apnea, which I do. You'd wake up maybe every 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And you'd be gasping really bad for air.
Yeah. How long ago did you get a CPAP?
I've been on CPAP since 2012.
Okay. Scott, do you use one? I thought you mentioned you have one too.
Yeah, I have one. I've had one maybe a decade now.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got a small trachea. That's part of it. And I don't need it as much when I get lighter. If I'm like literally, but I have to be, I slept one night. I fell asleep like, and maybe it was 2013 or something. It was the night after the Masters Nationals. I laid down as exhausted and I woke up in the hotel room freaking out because I didn't know where I was.
Yeah.
And I didn't have my CPAP mask on. I'm like, how can this be? It was light outside. Like what's going on? And it was just so bizarre. I was actually happy once I realized I had, you know, slept without CPAP, but, yeah, it's really, I mean, there is a risk of death, of course, and sleep apnea is associated with increased cardiovascular risk and strokes, sure. And it's not a good thing. So, yeah. That's actually kind of scary. And Jordan, I don't know if we ever talked about it. I actually have a battery for my CPAP if I need to travel. I tried using it when I flew, I think, to the UK on a night flight, maybe. Once and it didn't work. I just couldn't sleep because it was the plane, but
sure.
It's worth it. You can get like pretty cheap batteries actually. It doesn't like there's some that are generic, you know, that aren't like, you know, the official CPAP battery made by whoever makes your CPAP. So it's a thought.
Like whilst I was ill, trying to sleep with it was really, really hard. I told you about it, didn't I? Like I just couldn't breathe at all. That made me think about getting a dehumidifier for mine. I'm not sure if you have ever used one.
Mine actually has a humidifier on it, but I don't ever use it. I've never needed it.
Really? I use a CPAP as well. All part of the Muscle Minds. We're bonding with our CPAP stories here. Yeah. Mine has a humidifier. You're supposed to use it. That's what they told me. So I fill it every time, but you don't use yours, huh?
No, that's what they told me. I followed orders and did what I'm supposed to do. And, I didn't notice any difference. I don't ever get a dry throat. Some people get really dry throat, a sore throat.
And, yeah.
Yeah. I don't get any of that. I prefer something about the way in which the pressure is delivered. I like it much better when the humidifier addition is on there. But when I travel, I don't take that thing with me, and it still works just fine. It feels different. It's not as comfortable.
Gotcha.
But
so yeah. Jordan, you're saying there's a dehumidifier?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm probably talking about the same thing as what
Okay. Gotcha. So you don't put water in yours currently?
No, mine doesn't have that feature, but I can buy an attachment where I can add water.
It helps me. It does big time. Because Scott, I get that. I get like my throat will get dried out overnight if I don't. But having that humidifier helps to, I feel great, man. I love the thing. I wouldn't sleep without it either.
I was tempted to buy a new CPAP as well because I need the pressure changing on mine. But I don't go through like the National Health Service anymore with mine. Like originally I was prescribed it, but the whole service and the whole interaction with the nurses and the doctors was so poor that I ended up just paying for mine privately the next time, just because I couldn't deal. So I buy mine privately over the internet. Like because at one stage my CPAP broke, and I literally couldn't even get hold of the doctors or the nurses to get a replacement.
I remember that.
Wow.
And I was like, we were talking, Scott, weren't we? And I literally was like, because it broke just before I was going to go out to Tampa to see Scott.
Oh, wow.
They literally broke the night before my flight.
Oh, God.
And I couldn't get hold of anyone to replace it. So obviously I couldn't go away, which was really annoying. And then I ended up just being like, screw this. And I just paid for them privately.
The guy in the back alley behind the dumpster.
I get mine off of EUCPAP.com.
Nice.
They're a pretty good site actually, because if you don't have a prescription, they'll send you a pulse oximeter and you'll sleep with that, and then you'll post it back, and then they'll be like, fine, we can now write you a prescription.
Nice.
So they're very good. So if people have CPAP in the UK and we're in Europe and they don't want to have to deal with that process, because I know for some people as well, if you go through the NHS and you have severe CPAP like I do, then you can't get insured with your driving. Because in the UK, they won't insure you.
Wow.
So you could go through this service and then not have to disclose it to the DVLA.
Nice.
So, which of course would be someone's own prerogative, because that might be illegal. I don't even know.
Yeah.
But because I got mine initially on the NHS, I can't drive. So, because I'm not allowed to be insured, which is really frustrating. But that being said, I think I'd probably crash and kill someone, so I would never. I wouldn't take the risk anyway, because I fall asleep so often when I'm sitting in cars. Like as soon as I'm in the car, that's it. I'm asleep.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
See, that tells me, Jordan, I've seen this a few times now, but it tells me that there's some apnea that's not being resolved.
I was thinking the same thing.
Shouldn't be that tired, you know? Yeah.
This is why I need that pressure increase, I think.
Yeah.
Because I do still feel moments of that sleep apnea tiredness through the day.
Yeah.
Like it gets me every now and again. I'll lay down on the sofa and I'll be like, geez, I feel really tired, and that's not like a normal tiredness.
Yeah,
right.
So that's why I'm gonna get that sorted soon.
Well, look, Sorry, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to add, you know, benefit for everybody out there listening to that doesn't know anything about sleep apnea. What Jordan's talking about and what we're talking about, you don't always necessarily even know that you're waking up. This could be something where, you know, you do a test and then you find out that, you know, you've woken up, you know, 200, 300 times a night, but you fall right back asleep and you don't even realize it. So just because you don't know that you have it, if you're a bigger dude, there's a chance, you know, and like Scott's saying, I think it's really important to get tested, because if you do have it, I mean, even if you're not going to die, you know, because of it instantly, it is going to be a lot more pressure on, and, you know, on your heart and whatnot.
I went, this is a kind of a story for those who aren't quite sure. I got a couple pieces. One, if you have a significant other or someone, you know, be willing to like come over and, you know, stay at your house and listen to you when you're sleeping. This happened years ago. A friend of mine, I stayed at her house. I slept in her bed. She slept. There were three turns through the hallway and two doors closed, and she could still hear me snoring.
Mm, good.
And it was like 20 yards away outside of the house, multiple walls because of the turns. And she said, you know, you hold your breath when you're sleeping. Mm. I'm like, yeah, I thought I might. And she's like, how long do I hold my breath for? She's like, oh, until you just about die. Like, it was well over a minute. Wow. So that's something. And then the other thing is, I recognized this. I had all the signs and symptoms when I went in, and you know, I did this all on my own. I found a PA who does sleep studies. He, you know, does the polysomnography, and he mostly works with obese individuals. Hmm. A lot of doctors or PAs or nurse practitioners, whoever can legally prescribe CPAPs wherever a person might live, doesn't know that just simply having a large neck or being heavy in body weight is a risk factor. It doesn't have to be that you're obese. So I went and you know, talked to this guy, and I, you know, very succinctly outlined the you know, the risk factors as I understood them and the signs and symptoms that had presented themselves to me. And he's just listening to me like, what the hell is this guy doing? What's he thinking? And he's like, okay. So he just like started to feign going through an exam, and he looked in my throat, and he could see that I had a small trachea immediately. Hmm. And he's like, okay, let's get a sleep study done. And I'm like, why? He's like, oh, your trachea is really small. That's what's, you know, that's what's giving you part of this issue. Hmm. So he knew right away, but I had to convince him. Like a lot of people, you know, you kind of go in, you do what your doctor says. They just wouldn't listen to you. They wouldn't even pay attention. So if you suspect at all, push. My thought is to really push for, you know, the sleep study, if at all possible, because it could save your life, could save someone else's life. Yeah. If you're driving, you know. And then the third thing I was going to say before is, depending on the model, they have different terms depending on the brand, but a lot of the CPAPs are variable pressure. So there's constant pressure units where you need to prescribe a particular pressure. And then the variable pressure ones adjust the pressure depending on what's needed, which will change for an individual slightly during a night. But it also changes if you're a bodybuilder and you have weight fluctuations, 30, 40, 50 pounds. So I would, when I would be like 260, I needed a lot of pressure. I mean, it was like trying to blow the mask off of my face. I had to strap the sucker down really tightly.
Yeah.
And then I didn't need it when I was like, you know, the night after a show and I'm like 215.
Right.
I didn't need it. I fell asleep without it on and I slept great. So there's a tremendous variability. And if you get the right unit, that will adjust the pressure to what the person needs, then you don't have to go through the rigmarole of, you know, repeatedly getting prescriptions and go, that's just ridiculous. It's just silly. Even with the pulse oximeter, that's a nice thing, but still, the right unit can adjust. So that's, of course, that's what your doctor or your PA, whatever, should discuss with you. But this is my understanding, and this is the unit that I have, and this is what works for me. So
yeah,
hopefully it's helpful to somebody.
And you know what, too? I know that the guys that have it the worst, they go beyond CPAP and go into the BiPAP, where not only is it giving you that positive pressure, but from what I understand, the BiPAP is negative pressure. Is that right, Scott?
They can adjust both directions.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So that's and variable. And I could see that that's okay. So that's variable. That's what that means is so BiPAP that's is variable.
One pressure. Form of it. Yeah, that's one form of it. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, maybe that's so, even what Jordan needs. Not that we could diagnose him, but
no, I know. Couldn't. There's no way. But I just know the technology's there, and sometimes it kind of depends on like who you go to. Like this guy that I went to, he specialized in that. I asked around and found him. He didn't know anything about, you know, anybody than other than people who are morbidly obese for the most part. But yeah, there's and that was 10 years ago. I have no idea really what the current state of technology is.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd have to check into all that, but yeah, it's not a good thing to have sleep apnea at all. There's been a few bodybuilders that have died because of that. There's a guy, national level competitor. He lived in Texas. He went in for a surgery unrelated to his apnea, and he even brought his CPAP in, and they dropped the ball after he was under anesthesia. Chelsea Graham, I believe, was his name.
Okay.
You can Google him, and the story, as I recall it, was they just didn't affix his CPAP to him during recovery from his surgery when he's anesthetized.
Wow.
Which can further depress your brainstem respiratory centers.
Yeah.
So he was even at greater risk for some issues due to the apnea, and without the CPAP, they signed the gravestone for him.
Oh, that's too bad. Because
it was terrible. Yeah, it was really bad. He was a really super nice guy. You can find interviews with him, and he was like a top five nationals level competitor. Really good physique. Okay. Yeah, Chelsea Graham.
That's quite common apparently. Because
yeah,
in 2012 when I first had mine, the same thing happened to me. I had to go into the hospital for an operation on my tricep. They put me under anesthetic, and then they completely panicked when they realized that I wasn't breathing on my own. They obviously sorted me out, but then I had to have a second operation that week. But the second time, they didn't get approval to put me under anesthetic for a second time, just because obviously the same thing. So I had to have the operation done whilst on local anesthetic.
Oh, wow.
Which was fucking brutal.
Mm.
But I could easily see how that could happen, because they really nearly screwed that up with me as well.
Wow.
Yeah. I think his CPAP was right there in the room. From what I recall, like literally, they just, you know, they didn't know what they're doing.
Mine was too.
Yeah, so there you go.
When I went to the operation, my CPAP was on me, on my chest, because they unplugged it and I took it with me down to the operating theater. And then obviously they applied the anesthetic and I was gone. But I remember that they moved it off me and they put it onto the table next to me. So I don't know if they then got it on me when they realized that I wasn't breathing, but they worked something out, but they were too scared to put me under for a second time.
Yeah. No wow. Kidding.
Well, we have an interesting topic here today, and the reason I think it's especially interesting is, you know, Scott, you're a coach, and Jordan, you're a coach, and I do some coaching, and our topic of the day here is the benefits of not having a coach. So minds are blown right now, I'm sure. But nonetheless, why don't you get us started here, Scott? We had kind of a cool discussion about this through text over the past week, and I thought everybody had some really cool stuff to say. So I'm excited to hear, you know, what we come up with here today.
Well, you know, my thought, what has kind of become? Let me take a step back here, and if you sort of look at how people learn how to behave in general. We're social animals. Of course, I'm not a sociologist or psychologist. This is all armchair stuff. But
sure.
But I think it's pretty obvious, you know, common sense to a certain degree. We're social animals, so we look around and we see what people are doing. And we see, especially when you look for people that are successful in their endeavors, you try to mimic what they are doing in many cases. And the state of affairs in the industry has become such that there are many, many coaches. And I mean, if you think through the list of all the top competitors, almost all of them have coaches. Yeah. And I mean, and because many of the top people have just been competing, you know, the guys like Dexter are an exception, but many of them are competing just for the last 10 years when the sort of, you could say the rise of coaches has occurred. So when someone comes into, physique competition, it makes sense that they would think, well, this is done with a coach. This is how I should do this.
Yeah.
And what they may not think about is the fact that if you do your first show with a coach, especially if you take on the mindset that, that many people have and many people even brag about, is that that I have such strength of will that I will just, I'm a, just a machine. I'm an automaton, and I will carry out whatever my coach tells me to do each and every time, without question. So, you know, people, that's sort of that's the hardcore, I'm going to get after it mindset.
Yeah.
And that makes sense, of course. But on the other hand, that then means that whatever learning that one would come to have, in many cases, depending on the coach, some coaches are great teachers and they explain what they're doing. But it doesn't necessarily require that individual to understand what's going on as long as they can execute the coach's suggestions. So the learning is in no way requisite for quote-unquote success, at least in terms of creating a physique, you know, that's stage ready on the day of and getting good placings and what have you. So there's no mandate on the person to learn whatsoever. So you can get 5, 10, 15 shows into a career. You can go years and years and years having worked with a coach and really have a very little understanding of what it is that you're doing. You know, might know the mechanics, but you don't know why those mechanics are adjusted in various ways. And so that's more and more of a common occurrence. And I get, you know, inquiries, talk to people at the gym all the time, and they just immediately want to hire me. And I'm like, well, why do you want to hire me? It's like, well, that's, they don't even know why. And what I like to hear is, you know, I've competed 2 or 3 times, and, you know, I've seen, listened to some of the things that you've said, and I've looked into this, that, and the other, and I like the way you do things, but there's some things I just can't figure out, and I've been working on for several years now, and I think I could learn some things from you, and I have some questions I want to ask from you along the way. So I'm hoping that you can enrich my educational experience.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm looking for. And with people. And I think this kind of goes back to sort of like ethics of sports and the value of the value of playing a game. And this is or doing a particular type of competition. What's the value in bodybuilding, socially speaking? What does it do? You know, well, I mean, I guess it's a way of entertainment for people. It certainly is a way that some people can make money. You know, you could also say it fuels narcissism and egotism, and, you know, it emphasizes our, you know, focus on, you know, perfect bodies and creates, you know, sort of an air of body dysmorphia in our culture and what have you.
Sure.
Those aren't great things necessarily, but if there's something to be had from the endeavor itself that is intrinsically valuable, it could be one that you just enjoy the process. The process in itself is very, very cool. And I think, for me at least, much of what is had there comes from you being intimately involved with the process. The process being something that you are engaged in to the depth that you possibly can. There's a book that many of the listeners might, especially the older folks, probably have heard of. I didn't think I was going to talk about this today, but Robert Pirsig wrote it. It's called The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Yeah.
And there have been many, many spin-offs, The Art of It, Art of This, and Art of That. And in that book, it talks about one of the main themes is a motorcycle trip that he took along with another couple. And that other couple has some really nice bikes, and they just want to, like, get on their bikes. They just want to ride, and they don't want their bikes to break down. They don't have to deal with any of that. They just want to sort of escape on their motorcycles.
Yeah.
And Pirsig's of the other sort of is at the opposite end of the spectrum. He's like, there is so much value in learning how the mechanics of how my bike works and how to maintain it and how to fix it and how to make it better. Because then I'm intricately involved with the experience, and there's no separation between me and the bike and the road. I'm feeling all this out. So that's like an intrinsic value that I think can be missed if you got a coach who's your mechanic. He's doing all the work for you. You're missing out on those things. And you may just want to let go for the ride. The other thing that I think is important is the extent to which you can take the struggles, the difficulties that come with the prep. I mean, because really, I mean, this is as Shelby, and I like to say Shelby Starnes, and I say this is bodybuilding issues are first world problems. We've totally decided that we're going to do this. You know, we're going to sort of voluntarily starve ourselves, and then we're going to complain about how hungry we are or what have you. It's like, no. This is a totally an endeavor of your own creation. You could stop at any time. But when you dive into that and you get to this point, like, you know, I'm kind of hungry here. I'm not really sure what to do with my diet. I'm a little bit scrambled brained. Yeah. And then you have to center yourself and step outside of that, maybe that inner turmoil, and say, okay, this is how I think straight. I can make this. I can do this. I think this is just my my thought process, is that that sort of thing translates outside of the realm of bodybuilding. If you can diet down where you feel like shit a lot of the time in the last couple of weeks, and you're tired and you're dizzy, even like you have to get up slowly because you might fall over and all these sorts of things. And you can also recognize that I've done this to myself. You know, this is self. So I have no reason to worry about this. And you might even have the epiphany that there are people who live their lives not voluntarily. This is just how they feel because they don't have a food, or they have to work 12, 15 hour days just to barely make it. You can gain perspective there. And then when the bodybuilding show is over and you've got a rough day because your car broke down, okay, so I got to fix the tire in my car and it's 110 degrees outside. Okay, that ain't shit. That means nothing. What happens when I got to go squat? You know, when I haven't had any carbs for 3 days, that's a whole lot harder than changing a tire. So the rest of your life, you obtain an ability to see past things which might cause suffering because you don't want to do them, or they're painful for you and you reject them. And you say, this is really, in the broad spectrum of things, this is a breeze. So you can enjoy the rest of your life and you can see life through a new perspective. That comes, though, when you connect with the nature of the endeavor. And you have to undergo those struggles on your own. It's like running a marathon under your own volition versus having someone push you 26.4 miles in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
You traveled the distance, but when someone who's run a marathon, especially like an Ironman triathlon, I mean, those folks have done something that's, you know, really quite extraordinary. That's why the Ironman triathlete, they get the Ironman tattoos. Like, this is like, wow, we really accomplished something. And same thing goes, I think, for really pushing your limits in a bodybuilding show. So I think that one can really be denying themselves some of the intrinsic goods of bodybuilding and the ways in which it can make your life better outside of the competitive venue if you rely heavily upon a coach. Not as an educator, but as someone who relieves and releases the stress.
Yeah,
That's what you want. That's why you do this, because it makes you better. I'm not going to even invoke the overly used Nietzsche quote, but I think there's some truth to it. So, that's my thought in a very large nutshell.
Well, I think it's I think it's really good. I think I totally agree with where you're coming from. And I guess just to kind of take it further, I feel like, you know, I feel like the title we used here, the benefits of not having a coach, it's almost kind of extreme sounding, you know. I think it draws attention, but realistically, I feel like that with a good coach, and if you want to be educated, that you could then get even more. You know, I feel like that if you have somebody who's there to, the way I see it, it's almost like a mentorship or like an apprenticeship almost. You know, you, I think at the end of the day, I want to be my best as a competitor, and I think of myself coming into competing. I'm probably going to be more successful if I have somebody, you know, with me that's going to take me under their wing and kind of knows how to roll with the punches of dieting and knows, you know, what to expect and has some tools and ideas. It is, though, it's a totally different thing to just say, hey, do this versus, you know, somebody who wants to understand why. I think it's just night and day difference. And it's a shame to think that some people could go through, even to think like, and I don't want to use the word career, like in the fact that those of us that do this for a hobby, you know, I don't think career is the right word, but for lack of a better word, this, you know, our career in bodybuilding, that some of us may go through it without having learned these things about ourselves.
Yeah. An analogy, even better than I think the marathon, is, and I haven't done this, but I know people who have, is hiking the Grand Canyon. You can take guided hikes, all the way down to the Grand Canyon. It's quite an adventure to do that. And if you're with someone, you know, who really is a good teacher, that it's still hard as shit. You know?
It's still gonna
be a tough journey. But they're, you know, they're telling you when you're walking along, you're like, you see that line of rock there. You don't want to step on that because, you know, this, that, and the other. This is where we want to go. We want to take this way. And see, you don't grab onto, that's not a good foothold and that's not a good handhold. Because you can see this crack that's coming down there. That's probably going to break for you. So that's what a good coach does, is he makes you better at hiking. He makes you better at traversing that road. And you're better at hiking the Grand Canyon. You come in better on stage and you also learn. So you get that sort of intrinsic learning value out of the gig. You're able to even, you know, in a way, push yourself even harder. And so instead of like, okay, shit, I'm stuck, I don't know which way to go, you just stand there.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, I'm just totally befuddled, and maybe you fall down. Instead, you maintain a really brisk pace because you've got someone showing you how to do that. So you can actually make the prep harder.
Yes.
And better, and a better learning experience with a good coach who's showing you how and why to do those things, as opposed to just kind of pushing you along or just carrying you, you know, picking you up. And that might get you up there faster. But, so yeah, I think there's pros and cons to both. But I just hate to see,
carry me down the Grand Canyon. That's what I was picturing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Or up, I think, you know, down up. Yeah, both. I mean, they both have their own. You know, up could be off season, and down could be breed contest. I don't know which way.
Yeah.
Matches the other, but so, Jordan, do you have any thoughts on that one?
I do, and obviously mine echo yours very much. But one thing, the way that I've gone about it is, I've hired a coach, and I've kind of learned and taken on board some things, and then, after a period of time, I would then think, I'm now going to do a period of time on my own. And then after that period of time on my own, I would then hire maybe a different coach. And then I would spend some time with them. And then I would have another period of time on my own. And then I've gone to a different coach again. And then after that, I've had a period of time on my own. And that's the way I've done mine. So it's allowed me to expand my knowledge through learning from different coaches whom I thought would be the very, very best fit for me.
Yeah.
And then I've also had good chunks of making my own decisions and employing some of the techniques and some of the methodology that I've learned from those coaches. And then after working with different coaches and having different cracks at it myself, I've then kind of put it all together now into somewhere and something where I'm now very, very, very comfortable in just completely having the reins myself. And then obviously I'm fortunate enough to have Corin alongside me. And I think that that's been a really great way for me to learn how to do bodybuilding.
Yeah, I could see that.
And I advise people to do that. I think using different coaches and having periods of time of then coaching yourself is a great thing. So that's been my approach, and I think I've learned a lot from doing it that way.
Yeah, and you're a natural born learner too, and that's just in your nature. So, and what you're doing is it's really the opposite of coach hopping. You're taking that information and then you're testing it out. Like you soak it up and then you go solidify it by employing it, as opposed to just moving to the next coach.
Yeah, I've never been keen on the idea of coach hopping, because coach hopping kind of insinuates that you're, in my mind, that people are disgruntled with the result. So they hop. And I've never, ever been disgruntled with a result from any competition I've ever done. Like, my whole motive for changing coaches is just solely been to learn more.
Yeah, I can see that. That makes sense.
And that's it. And then, like, what's funny is that I've been with, I think, four different coaches. And then after that period of four coaches, then the only person that I wanted to go back to for a second time of like official coaching was Scott, because of all the four coaches that I worked with, no one compared to how well I clicked and gelled with Scott. So that was why last year when we worked together, that prep was the most enjoyable prep I've ever had in my life. It was effortless, to be honest. And then that's because after a period of time of really learning what I know works, and then from working with different people, you can then get a good understanding of what feels right for you to rather enjoy the process.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because there's so many different ways you can go about getting yourself from A to B. Some people will train twice a day. Some people will do 2 hours of cardio a day. There's lots of different ways, and you need to work out what kind of works for you the best, but also what you enjoy doing.
Mm. Sorry, go ahead.
And yeah, once you have that kind of sussed out, then I think things click into place a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. And I think some people, like, literally, they just, what they want, they don't want it to be a learning process. They want it. I mean, it's a luxury service to be coached by someone, really.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, like, that's like going in for a massage. Like, I don't want to be taught how to do massage on myself. I want you to do it for me. And that's, you know, that's okay. Except in this case, you can't actually do massage on yourself. You can't actually coach yourself. And those people are missing out on that possibility. But maybe they have, like, they don't feel like they're missing out at all. And that's all right too. But they just might. I just have seen so many folks who can get schnookered when you don't obtain enough knowledge to be able to distinguish what coach might work for you and why coaches maybe weren't successful with you. So you coach hop because you're not gaining the perspective from each coaching experience to know to make a decision on the next coach.
Well, not to mention just health and safety too.
Yeah, all that. Yeah, for sure. Especially with the women.
Yeah,
that
seems to be,
that's the biggest issue there.
Let me ask you guys this then. So let's go to the other end of the story here. You know, as coaches, somebody comes to you and they say, they just, hands are out, and they say, take my money and just get me in shape. Do the thing you do. Do that thing you do and make it happen. How do you respond to somebody who's like that?
Like, I think I've said this before that I try to work out who's going to be like a bit of a red flag to me. And then I try to suss out their background and the way that they've gone about their bodybuilding in the past. And you can usually work out whether someone is going to be coachable or not.
Well, I'm not even saying coachable. I mean, maybe you might take somebody who they will do everything that you tell them to do, Jordan. They're going to eat exactly what you say to eat, you know, train exactly how you say to train. And they may even get into great shape, but they may also not even think about it. Does that bother you as a coach that somebody could go through that experience, or is it even your responsibility to care about that? I mean, I guess that's a question too. You know, they may end up looking great at the end, and you'll provide them with that service, but maybe let's say that they didn't care about learning what they were doing.
If someone doesn't care to learn, then I don't care to teach them.
Yeah.
That's my stance on that, to be honest. Because I feel kind of sorry for people that are closed off and they don't want to learn. And I don't understand it either. Like, I want to know the why of everything. Hmm. But if someone doesn't want to learn, then, and all they want to do is be a robot, then I can do that. I have clients that are like that, and it's no problem to me at all. I mean, I'm not going to tell someone how they should go about living their life.
Okay, there you go. I think that's, you just hit the nail on the head there then.
Yeah.
I'm a little different.
We all have our own motives and our own things that we want to take from this experience.
Mm, okay.
To some people, it's just literally the end product.
Yeah.
Whereas for others, it's the process, and then the end product is just literally that. It's an end product, and it's more of an experiment, and that's the way I like to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
The end process is just then the result of what you try to learn and put into practice, and then you get to assess that end result and alter as you see fit. But I mean, everyone's going to look at this in a different way.
Now, you were saying you look at that a little bit different, Scott. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I echo what Jordan said. I mean, I think the destination is the journey, so to speak. You know, it's that, I mean, where you happen to place, I mean, who knows? It's always very cool if you look really good, you know, but sometimes if you don't look so good, you're like, oh, you can learn something from that too. I value, you know, the learning process much more than, you know, the actual end result. And I have no money, you know, I'm not competing as a professional or what have you. I mean, you don't want to just come in looking awful. That doesn't help professionally either. But if someone wants to be a robot, one thing I found to varying degrees is that sometimes because of the depth of questions and the intricacies that I like to try to tease out with people, if someone's not got their thinking cap on, that can be just kind of a horrifying experience, because they don't think about the question that you're asking or what the implications are. You know, you say, how do you sleep at night? And then they might just say, fine. And in this case, this might go along with their sort of mentality of wanting to be a robot. And when indeed they don't sleep very well, they're just like, I can suck it up. I don't, you know, sleep doesn't matter. I'm just going to train and eat and do whatever. But I actually want to know how well they sleep, because that's vital for their recovery.
Yeah.
So sometimes you'll find out. I've had some people that, you know, I'm trying to remember some of the details, like you're, you know, weeks into it and you find out like that they were doing something completely different than what you thought they were. And they just, it's because they just were like kind of blindingly going after it. But the other thing that I think of is I have to, my personal mission and where, you know, I sort of fit in the grand scheme of things is, I feel like I've got, sort of a responsibility. I think that's the word you used even, Scott, to integrate myself sort of into the landscape of the health and fitness and bodybuilding world in the best way that I possibly can. And I think the service that I can best provide is going to come by being an educator as often as I possibly can. So if I take on, you know, 5 or 10 clients and spend time with them, you know, where they're not thinking, I'm just sort of telling them what to do, that takes away from some other clients who I could be, you know, benefiting really, really quite a bit more, I think, because we could also get them in good shape, but they also could be learning quite a bit and avoiding mistakes. And then I find those people, then they will pay that forward. They'll take that information and disseminate it. And they might have someone in the gym. It's like, hey, you know, you might try this interworkout thing. You know, I got this coach and, you know, I was kind of like wondering about it, but he's real big on it. So we did it and it worked really well for me. Why don't you give it a shot? So, you know, word spreads. And I've had some, I now I think about it, sort of in a way, I haven't really thought of it this way, but you know, Jordan was, as you mentioned, he's been a client of mine and Jordan's kicking friggin' ass. How awesome is that? You know, if Jordan hadn't been coached by me, I know that he would still be kicking ass, but I think that, you know, I like to think at least I played some role in how well he's doing. And I've had
a huge role.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's say I just took on a bunch of people and, you know, and I didn't happen to train Jordan. I might've missed out on that. And, you know, I've had a couple other, clients who were coaches who've done really well for themselves too. So, I feel like I need to let someone else take on the robot type clients who want to do that, not sort of, you know, judgmentally per se, but,
I think the way that you coach, if someone is receptive enough, you could give them all the tools that they need to become an exceptionally good coach themselves. Because I know for a fact that I would have been not even half as decent a coach as I am if I didn't work with you. Like, there's no doubt in my mind about that.
Thanks,
the way that you coach is very unique. But I think someone has to be receptive to wanting to learn.
What's so unique about it, Jordan?
He has the answers to everything.
I'm a good bullshitter. I can Google the fuck out of shit is what it is.
Like, just in terms of physiology and understanding the processes, it frustrates me a lot because I have this issue still now with my current masters, that even some good educators have big gaps in their knowledge on fields that aren't really of interest to them, which is no disrespect. I think that's fairly common amongst academia, that people will only invest their time into what they're interested to learn. But Scott has a very, very, very broad knowledge of fucking everything. So that's why. I mean, I don't think that there is a better bodybuilding physiologist on the anywhere than Scott. Which is why I like I said, I try to credit him for that every opportunity I get, and I always will, because that whole process with me when we were working together for a few years was just invaluable, really.
Yeah, see, so that's why I like to help people that I know will go on and help others, like Jordan has, who won't, you know, just take on, you know, take what I suggest that they do and just execute it, but not remember it and not disseminate it. So I've kind of fashioned my own personal mission statement as that of an educator. So I can have an impact focusing on fewer clients, but those clients then, you know, that sort of magnify, the quote unquote good that I do by paying it forward to many other people.
That's pretty awesome too, that you can be in that position to do that. Cause obviously that takes a lot of time.
Yeah, it does. But I mean, it's really invaluable. Like, I had a guy just the other day, and he's actually having sleep issues. And, you know, some of this comes just from all the little things that I've done. I mean, I was, you know, I'm still a licensed acupuncturist, so that's a holistic form of healthcare.
Yeah.
So, you know, sleep is really important. Digestion is really important. And so I'm, you know, in doing that, I've learned a few things that can help with those issues. And of course, bodybuilding coaches deal with that too. But, so I gave him, basically an exercise that I fashioned based upon what I know of him and sort of how far, what he can do, a way to sort of reconceptualize his sleep surroundings. Some basic things like, you know, make sure there's no light in your room, you know, just actually an imperceptible blip of light can reset your circadian rhythm. So the minimal light that you have, the better. You know, talk just things like how far is it to your toilet, and you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I gave him sort of an exercise to deal with how he goes into his room and how he sees his room as a respite. Like, this is your sanctuary, away from the difficulties of your life, away from the thoughts of your work. When you go into your room, I said, when you reach the threshold of your door, this is paraphrasing what I sent to him, you get to the threat. Every time you walk into your bedroom, you get there, I want you to take a big breath deep in and release it, and realize it, that when you're in your bedroom, and especially when you're lying on your bed, you're on vacation. There's nothing to worry about. Everything's all right. And that's just how it is. Every time you walk in your bedroom, do that. Especially when you lie down at night. And he read it to his wife. He said, this is great. This is awesome. There, he was really excited, you know? So those kinds of things, you know, it took a while to write that all out to him. And I, you know, I just checked on the sleep because, you know, I was just concerned about it. We hadn't really talked about it before, but like, how awesome is that? You know, just to be able to, he made a comment. He's like, you're helping me in, you know, ways that I never expected, yeah, you know, outside the realm of bodybuilding. I'm like, yeah, that's the thing. Like, this stuff should really enrich your life, beyond just a trophy or some cool pictures or, you know, being an Instagram hero or what have you. This should be, you know, this is, this should be much more important if you're going to put this much time and effort and put your heart and soul into all this. So that's totally worth it to me, man. Like, that's, he might have a buddy at work who's got a hard time. He's like, dude, you got to try this.
Right.
This is why, you know, and he passes that along. That's awesome. You know, how cool is that? So that's why it's worth it to me.
I feel like, the generation that I came up in bodybuilding, it was still really important to do your own research. You know, I feel like if you went online, you went to the message boards, the first thing you ask is a basic newbie question. They're just going to tell you right away, you know, go do your research. You know, that question's been asked 100 times.
Read the stickies.
Yes. Yeah. Stuff like that. I feel like that's it's kind of been lost a little bit. I feel like people just expect that now. They feel like, as you're saying, that you decide to become a person in fitness. I'm not even going to say bodybuilding, because I you know, any form of the physique sports. And then you decide, you know, you're going to get your gym membership, you get your gear, and then you get your coach. Usually, you know, in that order, all in the first week. And I agree, man. I feel like had it not been for doing my own research and learning things on my own, when I had gotten my first coach, all that stuff wouldn't have made as much sense to me, you know, as it did. And I feel like realistically, if people were to do that more often, there would probably be a lot less need for coaches. There wouldn't be so many of us out there.
Of course, you know, coaches, you know, some of them, you know, there's good and there's bad coaches. It's like there's, kind of true for everything. There's various reasons why people would coach. You know, you're talking about information, and I wish I could remember exactly what the quote was and exactly the details of it. But I think it was something roughly along the turn of the century, into the 20th century, that the quote, something along these lines, this isn't exact, but that the information that you might find, the information that you might find in one edition, like one daily Wall Street Journal, is more information than someone at the turn of the century, into the 20th century, would be exposed to, the average person in the United States would be exposed to in their entire lifetime.
No kidding.
Yeah. The information explosion is just absolutely mind-boggling. It's beyond exponential.
I could see that, though. Yeah, the more I think about it, the more I could see it.
So all these questions, almost all of them that were being asked, except when they come to, like, you know, new drugs and, you know, new devices and things that have just popped up recently, but most of them have been answered dozens upon dozens upon dozens of times. And what I think is confusing is that the answers are so different and disparate in many cases. But people aren't even looking into that. So as I've said before, like, asking a question on most discussion boards or even the internet is kind of like walking into a library and saying, you know, what's the meaning of onomatopoeia? It's like, well, you, there's the dictionaries over there. All you gotta do is go look it up. You know, it's right there. And but people don't want to do that for whatever reason. And it's just so it's like, man, this internet thing is so cool. This is unbelievable. This is amazing. I spent hours just like Googling around and looking shit up. It's just, you can download papers instantaneously. I mean, back when I had to do this, back in the day when I was doing my graduate work, you'd go to the library, you'd find the papers, you had to look them up. Some, like, your chest Medline was just coming available. Sometimes you just have to read a paper, and then you'd find the other papers, and you'd go and look those up. Like, you'd make note of it on, you know, scratch it down. I knew the call numbers of, like, you know, 30 journals off the top of my head, and you just go and you'd find the journal, and you'd find the volume and the number, the issue and the pages, and then you'd go and you'd photocopy those. I have a monster, like, cart full of books, and I'd spend 2 hours photocopying. So I'd search for 4 hours, and then I'd spend 2 hours photocopying before the library closed, and I might get, like, 40 papers out of that. I could get those 40 papers now in like, 20% of the time. So it's just, like, it's crazy. But people, we just adapt to human nature. We don't recognize how good things are because we don't have the contrast of previous perspective.
Well, I think this is all some good stuff. Let's answer a few questions while we're on the line here.
Cool.
Hopefully that's given some people some stuff to think about. I hope it does. Scott, you actually had one, didn't you? This was from where was your question from? Was that at the forum itself for Fortitude Training?
Oh, yeah. I think I posted this one on Facebook, maybe. I can't remember. I answer so many questions. The question was, this one we talked about it before, was how would one modify fortitude training for a women's figure competitor? And the interesting thing there, I mean, the simple question is you would just apply the same sort of paradigm of thought to modifying any bodybuilding program to anyone's physique that needs to be developed in certain ways. So it's like, you know, you have a car and you want to make it really stand out, then you use bright colors. You want a car that's going to be stealthy, you use dark colors. So it doesn't matter whether it's a Chevy or a Corvette or a truck or what have you, it still apply the same idea. But the interesting thing about this was, of course, women's physique in particular. And, you know, a lot of women, they want to work on their legs and their butt, what have you.
Yeah.
So it brought up, I just sort of was, as I tend to do, just sort of thinking about some more aspects of this. And I thought about this, this notion, and Jordan mentioned this is really big. And I totally agree. It's really big in Brazil. This sort of trend. It's like a physique trend. It's a change in the aesthetics in the land of social media and Instagram, in women's, when what constitutes sort of an attractive or a fit women's body. And the trend is to have highly, really muscular and well-developed legs, especially a butt. This, of course, you know, totally fits with bikini. The way so many bikini competitors train, they'll spend 50% of their training volume on training their glutes.
Oh, yeah.
And that's not an exaggeration in some cases, I don't think.
No.
Yeah. And they will then, you know, just try to have almost minimal muscularity, be lean, of course, in their upper body. So the interesting thing there is I think this is a really kind of a cool phenomenon. On the one hand, you know, men would typically see more muscle mass. It's just sort of, there's a biological difference between the sexes. Men carry more muscle mass than women.
Yeah.
So a woman gaining muscle mass, this is just the standard. I'm not saying that muscular women are not feminine because I love muscular women. there's no doubt about that in my mind. But that's typically the biologically programmed thought is that a really muscular woman has taken on masculine characteristics in doing so. But on the other hand, women, biologically speaking, have relatively more muscle mass in their lower bodies. So a woman that gains a lot of lower body muscle mass is, in one sense, pushing towards a masculine aesthetic in a certain way because of the extraordinary muscle mass that some of these women have. You always see the memes of, like, you know, somewhere there's a woman who can out-squat you, and you see this woman with these just crazy muscular legs. So that's pushing towards a muscular or a sort of a masculine aesthetic. But in just having that muscularity and that larger amount of muscle mass contained in the lower body, that's emphasizing this natural feminine aesthetic. So it's you're kind of going both directions, but those women look phenomenal. They look incredible. Some people like, I don't like that look. It doesn't look balanced, doesn't look okay to me, but it's really kind of cool, at least in my mind. I think this is sort of a nifty phenomenon, the way it sort of, it hacks past that tendency to see more muscle mass as being a masculine feature because that muscle mass is only in the lower body. So the femininity is retained in that way. So you can do that and get away with more muscle mass as a woman and still look really, really feminine. And of course those, you know, women are very beautiful, and it seemed like it's a new aesthetic that's coming into being that I just found fascinating. So I commented on it.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. I've got a question over here that I'm really curious to hear what you guys have to say about this. He's a 6'2", lifetime natural, 24-year-old, 212 pounds. He's reading at 9% body fat on a DEXA scan. Been lifting for 10 years. And he's at a point where he feels like he could realistically use another 5 to 7 pounds on his back and shoulders to place better than he has. He competes in men's physique. So he says, my legs are by far my strongest point. I could squat 405 for reps rather easy, but the judges can't see them because of the long board shorts. Would it be beneficial for me to stop training legs whatsoever for the next off season when trying to push mass up into the upper body, or would that hinder my progress overall because of the lack of hormonal response? He adds that I'm currently running a JP-inspired workout, a three-way split, low volume, high frequency, and progressive overload while very, very slowly increasing my calories. Basically follow everything JP and Scott advocate to a T, from carb back loading to peri-workout supplements, etc.
I think it would be a mistake to stop training legs.
Yeah.
You're going to get overall strength benefits that have a lot of carryover to your upper body movements from getting very good at deadlifting and squatting. Mm. And I think it would be a mistake to stop doing that. Like, furthermore as well, like, realistically, I know competing is obviously important to people, but you just have a group of guys that you don't know, a group of random people that you don't know, telling you what is good and what is not good about your physique. I mean, potentially stopping training your legs just to, like, appeal to a group of random people, to me, is crazy. Because everyone has huge appreciation for awesome legs. And I think if you love bodybuilding, which it sounds like you do, surely you love having the idea of really awesome legs. So I don't think you should ever let that idea go. It sounds like you're on the way to maxing your physique out, to be honest. And if that's the case, then you're at a crossroads of what you do next to get that extra tissue on you. But stopping training your legs is certainly not the way to go about it. I can assure you that.
What do you think, Scott? I don't even have to ask what you think, but let me ask. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I mean, I'd want to see him. He's 6'2" and 212 at 9%. So
That's 9% on a DEXA, though.
On a DEXA, yeah. He's pretty fucking lean, exactly. So,
So that's shredded.
Yeah, so maybe staying too lean, and he may need to just allow his body fat to go up. What he can do is figure out, how much, if he has access to this DEXA, how much fat-free mass he needs to get this extra 5 to 7 pounds up top. Chances are some's going to come with his legs. So he may need 10 pounds of fat-free mass. So he may need to put on 20 pounds, maybe he needs to get like 12 pounds of fat-free mass, because he may lose a couple when he's dieting down, especially if he's natural and it's new muscle tissue. So he may have to put on 25 pounds at, 6'2", and, that would put him at 237. That's not gigantic at that height at all. He's only 24. So I think before he stops, just want to completely eliminate leg training. I think I'd look at the big picture. Other thing, I like to know how he trains. I mean, if his legs are so good because he just buries himself on leg day, and maybe he just doesn't do what is he doing for upper body? Is he just doing like Jordan's favorite, a lot of squeeze movements and pump movements, that kind of stuff? There may be some other things that he can do. There's a lot of other strategies that you can tackle this problem with before you just eliminate the leg training. So he might, cut that back. Maintaining is easy. That's not a problem. Also, he could start wearing tighter fitting shorts that show off his legs. I think it would still have an impact.
Yeah.
And also, what about changing divisions? If there's a classic physique division, that he can, I mean, I imagine at 212 at 6'2", he would fit in the classic physique here in the States. I'm not sure what the numbers are, but, if he was at 220, so he could do that. And the other thing is, he's worried about hormonal responses. My take on the literature is that the exercise-induced elevation of testosterone or growth hormone is not going to contribute to upper body size, so he's not missing out on that.
Okay.
I think there is some benefits just overall neurologically in terms of setting a standard for how much central drive you produce when squatting or deadlifting or doing big heavy movements that typically involve the legs, that has some carryover. You're used to getting under a squat bar where your blood pressure feels like your head's going to pop off your neck.
Yeah.
And doing a heavy press, or a heavy bent over row isn't that big of a deal. So I think there's some carryover there. I mean, heck, just those heavy leg movements. I mean, you want big traps? Get a big deadlift and, squat with a heavy load on your back. That'll build traps. Some people don't have to do any direct trap work if they can deadlift, 4 or 5 plates off the floor for a lot of reps. So there's some upper body benefits to, some of the lower body stuff he may be doing. As far as hormonal, I wouldn't look to that as a mechanism he's going to be missing out on. The research doesn't really support that notion.
Right on.
Yeah. So
next question was about insulin. It says, what's the best way to ensure that insulin is being shuttled to muscle versus fat? You want to start us out here, Jordan?
So while we're training, we can potentially utilize those carbohydrates more efficiently. And during the training session, those carbohydrates aren't going to be stored as fat. So that's one way. And then obviously, if you're following an overall nutrient timing approach and you train really, really hard, the post-workout meal equally so has much less inclination of being stored as fat, provided you're not hugely overeating and you're being quite patient in your caloric increases, then that would be the area at which it would be most beneficial. Well, that's the areas in which I use my insulin. And I think that it certainly has a positive benefit. Also, like Scott and I were talking about this the other day, because this is something that's getting will become, and increasingly so, an interesting topic. The notion of the impacts on muscle protein breakdown. Because we're now obviously aware that hypertrophy and muscle growth may not solely be about muscle protein synthesis, and it may have a much bigger association with muscle protein breakdown. And we know that exogenous insulin has impacts on muscle protein breakdown. So using it at the workout perimeter and then maximizing its anti-catabolic effects there is also pretty wise. I don't see, personally, with that in mind, a use for insulin outside of the workout perimeter. And I can't see myself ever using it, let's say, breakfast or on rest days. So I think that's your best bet.
That makes sense. What do you guys think about, you know, some people say that eating dietary fats while you're using insulin will be more likely to store those dietary fats as, you know, adipose tissue. Is there any truth to that?
I certainly think that you could increase your risk of atherosclerosis and laying down plaque in your arteries. That's certainly something that we need to consider with high long-term use of insulin. So that could be an increase. I think I'm actually not too sure, to be honest, on the literature in regards to increased fat storage with exogenous insulin and dietary fat intake. Okay. So I'm not going to speculate. I'm sure Scott knows. I don't know the literature.
Yeah, I just figured I'd throw that one in there, because that one, I feel like it gets debated. Personally, I've eaten fats around the use of insulin, and I hadn't personally seen a difference, but that's just me, so I can't say that's the truth across the board.
Yeah, insulin is lipogenic and anti-lipolytic, pretty powerfully. So the issue that can happen is, if we imagine someone ate a high fat meal, typically there would be a lower insulin release. And that would in part mediate, those fats being oxidized and not stored so much. You know, that's sort of part of how it's all those pieces would fit together in terms of dealing with the nutrients. But yeah, when you bypass the situation by using exogenous insulin, then you've got those fats, which can go to adipose cells. They can go to the adipocytes, and insulin's going to favor that. It's going to very strongly inhibit any lipolysis.
Yeah.
And it's going to very strongly, stimulate lipogenesis. What I haven't been able, I've looked, and maybe I should look again, because they're first, it's funny because this has been known for a long time. Some Scandinavian researchers did some research like 20 years ago, is that you actually do use up intramuscular, intracellular, intramyocellular triglycerides in muscle cells with resistance exercise pretty substantially. You can cut the stores in half. Now, the stores aren't tremendous in size in terms of calories. But so that's a potential place where those dietary fats could go. I don't know to what extent insulin stimulates that. It would make sense given what it does in adipose cells.
Yeah.
That it would also have that effect on the muscle cells. So restoring that, this is one of the reasons why guys who get really well adapted to high fat or inter ketogenic diets can look pretty full a lot of the time.
Okay.
Is because they're basically, their cells have been fat loaded. So that's helping with that. You see that, like, Dave Henry's like that. The guy never goes flat. Only seen him flat like one time ever.
Yeah.
We really pushed him a long time ago.
That's funny. And he's such a genetic freak that it doesn't surprise me. Never been flat.
Like
one time.
Like, well, there was one time like, yeah, you actually went flat right now. That was remedied with, you know, just a sushi meal. Pretty much.
One time in 2002.
Yeah. But you've got a really nice situation, you know, when after you've trained, if someone's were to use exogenous insulin, you know, you've increased the volatility of protein turnover in the muscle cells.
Yeah.
You've elevated both synthesis and breakdown. The interesting thing, this is what Jordan was intimating, is there's now two studies that have come out. One, just as an abstract form as of conference proceedings, but it's it'll make its way out as a full paper, given the people who did it. And the first study found that when they measured the protein synthetic response to a resistance exercise, just a training bout at the beginning of a training program, that the robustness of that synthetic response was not predictive whatsoever of the eventual training gains. So you'd think, okay, you know, the guys who are going to grow the best are going to have the most robust protein synthetic response. And we know that that tends to increase in parallel with muscle breakdown response as well. And that one's much more difficult to measure. Technically speaking, the protein synthetic response, everyone's measuring this. And the assumption has always been that we can do acute measurements and we can see how some supplement or some modification, some treatment affects the protein synthetic response. And then that would then translate into what happens over the course of training when you summate bout after bout after bout for, you know, months on end. Well, the correlation was like 0.01. And then the more recent study that came out, they actually made measurements at the beginning of the training and then at the end. The idea being was like, well, you know, maybe that first bout at the beginning really doesn't represent what's going on in a, you know, a training session by training session basis. Things might be changing. It might be 2 or 3 weeks later, the guys who gain the best, then they start having the best protein synthetic response once the training gets up and rolling. So they measured at the end. Nothing. Still, the correlation was like basically zero. It was like 0.01 again.
Wow.
Silch. Like, it's almost crazy that it would be that low.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's no predictive value of the protein synthetic response. So that suggests it's the other side of the coin. You've got increased protein synthesis, and you've got increased protein breakdown, and the balance of those two is going to tell you about the protein accrual. How much you're synthesizing versus how much is broken down. The more you synthesize relative to what's broken down, the more protein myofibrillar tissue is it will accumulate over time. So that's what insulin does. It inhibits proteolysis. So you want to make sure you've got some protein there, of course, because that's going to help with protein synthesis, which you've also turned on. But the insulin is probably so effective for so many people, very much in part of this, because it's just shifting the balance towards an overall positive protein balance.
Yeah.
And, like, what are the fats doing for you? Not much. You want to restore glycogen because that's for performance. Fats, not so much. You're going to have plenty of time to get in fat, but that fat is basically going to, It's probably going to be stored as body fat because the insulin levels are so high. Typically, high fat meals don't produce so much insulin, so this has to do with the relative sensitivity of adipocytes, and that depends on the person and how lean they are, and a whole bunch of other things. So,
well, that's some awesome stuff right there. I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that it would. I hadn't known. I feel like in my own experience, maybe it's the amount of fats I had personally used, but I've heard it spoken both ways. So I think it's really cool to kind of hear a little bit more information. I'm going to get one more question here and then let's call it a day. And cool. This one is about juicing. I don't know if you guys are familiar, if you personally have any experience with juicing, but we're talking about vegetables here, by the way. Consuming large amounts of calories to ensure that you're getting your veggies in. He said, I personally struggle with around 100 grams of mixed greens per meal when pushing past 4,000 calories. and some veggies become totally off limits due to bloat. He wants to know if juicing his vegetables would be a potential option. Either you guys are welcome to jump in if you have any thoughts on this one.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I have the same thing all the time.
Hmm.
Once I go over 5,000 calories, I'm not interested in veggies. And I just use a greens powder. That's all I do. So I don't even bother with blending up or juicing. It's a completely viable option, but it's kind of time consuming. So I'm perfectly content just using a high quality greens powder.
Perfect.
Yeah, I mean that's a, you know, by Bite of Cost, Berrytastic is a good one. PhD Foods makes a good one. The one thing, I mean, I really like, for instance, I think we talked about this before, Scott, stuff like sulforaphane.
Ah, yeah.
You know, I mean, how much you're going to get? I think broccoli sprouts have glucoraphanin or something like that. It's a precursor to sulforaphane.
Okay.
And, you know, that's how that conversion happens. And you know, that'll happen inside the body. Those sorts of goodies, not to mention the fiber, which can be have prebiotic functions, are something you can miss out on by not taking in veggies. Now, I do the same thing Jordan does. You know, I sort of, you know, kind of take the easy way out. But getting the whole foods, I think, has some advantage. And what folks are starting to realize is that, you know, there's this gut-brain access, the gut, the microbiome, the microbiota, the bacteria in our gut have a tremendous impact on all sorts of things.
Absolutely.
Mood, depression, just the glycemic index of foods is substantially impacted by this. It can be predicted by the bacteria, the flora that are there. So this is, you know, actually eating the whole foods, the veggies and fruits in this way, it'd be a way to get those in. The thing to kind of keep in mind is that, of course, you know, is eating 4,000 calories. Now, if it typically you're eating 2,000 calories, then you might, you know, get, let's say, 400 or 500 calories from veggies and fruits. And that would be what, you know, I'm guessing, it's just sort of in this hypothetical situation, would be, you know, what's going to maintain his gut microbiome. And that's a sort of an adequate dose with a normal diet of those fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
Once he doubles his calories, it doesn't mean he has to double the fruits and vegetables, because the whole bodybuilding diet is like, you know, pushing to such excess. You don't necessarily have to keep all those things in place, especially if you start to get bloated.
Yeah,
so
that makes sense.
I think, yeah. So maybe, you know, he cuts his veggies just like one little glass, you know, one little, you know, amount, half of maybe what he might typically eat on a lower food intake diet, and then with greens formula on top of that. But you have to play with it and see what happens with his digestion, you know. That's kind of like the bottom line to a certain degree.
Right on. Speaking of the broccoli, I'm starting my broccoli sprout farm.
Oh, cool. I wondered about that.
Yeah. I'm excited to see what happens with it. And really, I feel like for me, I never get enough vegetables in. So it's going to be kind of a way for me to super boost that up. From what I understand, once you get the rotation going with like 6 different sprouting jars, you can have a kind of a nonstop production that will just last and last.
Right on. Are you going to post pictures on Instagram?
I will. Yeah. That's a great idea for sure.
Okay.
Their Facebook or something. So guys, this is about all the time we have. I appreciate both of you being here, and Jordan especially, I appreciate you making the effort, man, considering you're sick.
No,
it's all good. I'm well over the worst of it, so I'm fine.
We'll get that CPAP in order because we want to keep you around.
Sure.
And guys, I gonna head out and go do my training now myself. Both you guys have already trained today, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to go get to it. For Muscle Minds, I'm Scott McNally with Jordan Peters and Dr. Scott Stevenson. She blinded me with science.
you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at his website, fortitudetraining.net. Those who purchase Scott's book or any of his coaching products receive a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. So check out fortitudetraining.net. Muscle Minds is made possible in part by Jordan Peters. If you've enjoyed listening to Jordan today, check out his website, trainedbyjp.com. The site offers over 50 hours of video content covering everything from the most basic approach to training and nutrition for beginners, all the way through advanced anabolic and insulin strategies for seasoned competitors. You can follow Jordan and Corin's blog as they prep for their next shows and have questions answered daily on their forum section. So check out trainedbyjp.com.
Advices Radio Network.